Hello there, and welcome to the 9th episode of Dev Conversations, where we host developers that contribute to the Swift tooling ecosystem. Today we have someone that's been around for a long time in the iOS community, and is the author of an extremely popular tool, Swift Format. Hey, Nick.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's good, thanks.
Yeah, so last year it was quite a surprise for me when I was joining Swift Heroes, the conference, and I looked three rows behind me and I saw you. So that's where we met first time.
Yeah, I was there anonymously.
Yeah, and I've been wanting to chat with about these topics that we have for today for a while. And I've been trying for a while to reach you. And I'm happy we found the time. Before we jump into Swift Format, can you tell me a little bit about your early days as a programmer?
I mean, I've been interested in programming since I was a kid, really. I didn't do a computer science degree. I didn't do a traditional computer science degree. I actually did electronic engineering at university, and then kind of realized I'd made a huge mistake and did a year of sort of computer science catch-up stuff, and then got a job working as a front-end web developer, which wasn't really software engineering in any meaningful sense at the time. It was kind of just HTML and CSS, but it was the first job I could get that was kind of vaguely adjacent to my interests. And so for the first few years, I was mostly just tinkering and doing my own programming stuff, not really in my career. My big break, if you like, came in 2009 when I was working still as a front-end web developer, and I'd been doing a lot more JavaScript by that point. That was kind of like the heyday of like jQuery and all of that kind of stuff. So like, you know, front-end web development was becoming more of a software engineering discipline at that point, and we were writing a lot more code. Our client at the time asked if anybody knew anything about iPhone apps and whether we could build an iPhone app. And of course, our salespeople were like, oh yeah, sure, we know all about that. And then internally, it was like, okay, does anybody actually know about this? And then I'd got a book on development. I didn't even have an iPhone at that point in time, but I was, it looked like it was something that would be interesting to get into. So I stuck my hand up and said, yeah, I know how to do that. And that was kind of where it went from that point on.
So that's how it started on iPhone OS.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah. So I assume you had a Mac.
Yeah. I mean, I'd been an Apple fan for many years. I think I didn't have to get the first generation iPhone, but I got the second, like the iPhone 3G, pretty much as soon as it came out in the UK.
And then a few years later, you wrote the Core Animation book. How did you jump from a regular developer who just started developing on iOS to an author of a book on Core Animation?
It's a great question. So, I mean, when I first started doing iPhone development, there wasn't really a big open source community at all around iPhone and Objective-C. So almost everything you wanted to do, if it wasn't something that was built in, you kind of had to do it yourself. And I noticed, like in my work, I was working at an agency. So we did a lot of kind of fairly short projects for different clients. And a lot of patterns kept repeating, you know, things we needed over and over again. And often clients wanted, or, you know, the designers, you know, working on the client accounts wanted to use what they assumed were sort of out of the box things that you'd see, you know, in all of Apple's apps. And one of the obvious ones at the time was CoverFlow. Like Apple used CoverFlow everywhere, but Apple didn't give you CoverFlow as a component. And there was a couple of libraries out there that tried to replicate CoverFlow, but, you know, this was I'd been doing iOS for over a year at this point, so I had a reasonable idea what was going on. And I'd sort of figured out this kind of layering of, you know, underneath UIKit, you had Core Animation that was actually doing the heavy lifting. And I'd learned that Core Animation actually had some 3D capabilities. But the only libraries I could find that did anything like CoverFlow were all using OpenGL. They were basically doing everything from sort of first principles, which wasn't really like very easy to integrate into a, you know, user interface. If you wanted to have buttons and interactive controls inside your carousel views, then there was no way to do that really. They were just rendering images. So I thought, well, I mean, Core Animation can rotate things in 3D. Why don't I just do it that way? And then, as I said, like a lot of the time, these patterns kept repeating. And, you know, we needed the same thing over and over again. But because we were doing work for clients, like if we wrote some code for one client, we couldn't just use it for another client because, you know, they'd paid for us to write the code. So my sort of like workaround for this problem was that I started doing stuff as open source projects, which, you know, everybody understood that if it was an open source project, then nobody owned it. It was just like a library that you pulled in. The fact that I'd written all of the open source and was also writing the code for the client was kind of like neither here nor there. So that's basically how I got into it. It was just so I didn't have to write the same thing over and over again.
But did you have any experience previously on 3D graphics or?
Only as a hobbyist. I'd done some OpenGL stuff just for my own interest. I'd written a couple of games, not for iPhone particularly, but I sort of understood the principles from that. I was pretty much just self-taught, and I'm sure I wasn't doing things efficiently. But with Core Animation, it's a very high-level API. Like, you don't really need to know any maths or anything. You sort of have to have an idea of, like, what a 4x4 matrix is for, and, like, how it's, you know, kind of like how it's manipulating the values. But, yeah, beyond that, like, I mean, it does all of the maths for you.
And iCarousel helped on establishing your name in the community?
I think that was my first, like, well, it was close to being my first like big open source like thing that I actually released anyway, but it certainly was by far the most popular of all of the things I released. I mean, I had maybe like 50 different open source libraries that all did various different
You had
things.
iVersion also, right?
Yeah, a lot of things. I had a library called iRate, which was basically for showing like a rating prompt, you know, because like at the time everyone died on how many stars they had on the App Store. And that turned out to be quite controversial. It sort of got some negative attention, but it was also very popular, but not in the same league as iCarousel.
And by building iCarousel, you got all the knowledge about Core Animation. How did you learn all the little details about Core Animation? Did you have any experience on Core Animation on the Mac maybe?
No, not at all. I mean, Core Animation did come out for the Mac originally, but I didn't really, you know, I was never really a Mac programmer. I mean, even now I've written far more iOS code than I've ever written AppKit code. My understanding of the history of Core Animation is that it was really created for iPhone. It's just that it happened to ship on I think it was macOS Tiger, you know, like a year before or nearly a year before the iPhone was announced. But it was always intended to be an iPhone-like library. It was one of the first kind of, I guess, cross-platform, you know, APIs that Apple did, and you know, one of the things that kind of started tying the two different platforms together. But no, I didn't have any experience of it from before iPhone programming. It was purely just from basically doing my job and trying to get the iPhone to do these, like, you know, intricate things that the designers were asking us to do that nobody was really sure how to do.
Right. And nowadays, they're much easier with SwiftUI, right? You just, with a few lines, you can declare things to build with Core Animation.
SwiftUI still uses, I think, some Core Animation stuff under the hood, but it's kind of much less explicit now, I guess. Like, you know, SwiftUI's take on animation is much more declarative. I mean, Core Animation was also, in some ways, what made it easy or clever was the way that it was relatively declarative compared to a lot of animation libraries at the time. So for simple things, you would mostly just say, you know, here's where stuff is, here's where I want it to be, here's how long I want it to take. And it took care of the actual animation for you, rather than you having to do like a bunch of stuff with keyframes and so on. And yeah, there was kind of this interesting relationship between UIKit and Core Animation where they were kind of connected but worked slightly differently. In Core Animation, everything animates by default, and in UIKit, everything's not animated by default and you opt into animation. And it was interesting exploring how those two things were glued together. I didn't learn Core Animation from doing iCarousel. I did iCarousel because I already had learned some Core Animation. But what happened there was by doing iCarousel, I kind of gained some notoriety, which then led to a publisher, Pearson, approaching me about writing a book. And they suggested Core Animation as a topic. And I said, sure, I know a bit about that. And in order to write the book, I then did a lot of research and learned much more in depth what was going on.
That makes sense.
So yeah, having done that, I think I then had a pretty solid understanding of how Core Animation works, sort of like from top to bottom.
Yeah. A lot of people, whenever they need to teach it, either it's if it's a talk or a book, that's how you really learn it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the reasons I like to do things like give talks or, you know, like write posts about things is because it's a good way to learn, right? Like you never learn something as well as when you try and explain it to somebody else.
Totally agree. Yep. And fast forward a few years, Swift is announced. How long after that you came up with the idea of Swift format? When did you feel it was a necessity?
So I'd always been kind of annoyed by the lack of a good formatting solution for Objective-C, actually. You know, there was a lot of different styles that people adopted for their Objective-C code, and there wasn't really any good way of, like,
forcing.
Applying consistency. There was Clang format, but it was extremely fiddly and difficult to configure and so on. And, you know, I guess it had crossed my mind to try and write my own formatter. Like parsers and that kind of thing is something I'd always found interesting. It's kind of like parsers and 3D were my two kind of hobby, but it wasn't practical really for me as an individual to write a formatter for Objective-C, because Objective-C sits on top of C, and C has things like macros, and it's basically like an almost infinite number of like different like weird syntaxes that you might have to consider. And then there was C++ as well, and you know, it just didn't seem like a viable thing. And I mean, it seems strange now in retrospect because Swift has grown into quite a complex language, but at the time Swift seemed a lot simpler.
Yeah.
It didn't have like all of these kind of macros and weird sort of syntax.
And the number of reserved variations. Keywords.
Right, yeah. So I mean, it seemed like an achievable thing. And my motivation for doing it is that basically I just started at a new company and I was really using Swift heavily for the first time at this point. And they had essentially no like code style standards whatsoever, different indenting, different spacing on, you know, even within the same file. And it was just like a mess. And it was one of these things where I could just tell that culturally, like nobody else cared about this, right? Like there was no way that I was going to be able to make anybody else care. And I didn't want to spend all my time kind of in code reviews just annoying people by saying, hey, would you mind like, you know, sorting out this white space? Like it's not really the right sort of, you know, thing to use like GitHub PR reviews for. So I thought, well, if I just have a, you know, if I just make a tool that just applies a style, then like presumably people aren't going to mind that. Like, you know, if it's just something that happens automatically, they don't actually have to worry about it. Like if they don't care about styling, they're not going to care if I restyle stuff. So I just thought, okay, I'll just do this in my spare time then as a like interesting activity. And then hopefully it'll also make my work life easier, or at least more pleasant.
Yeah. And so how did you approach the implementation? Because this is, parsing is not a simple topic. And
no. So, I did initially look around to see what else there was available. Apple had a tool at the time called Swift-Format. Like it was this thing that was checked into their repository, but it was kind of, it seemed like it, somebody had maybe like done some bare minimum effort there and then abandoned it because it hadn't been touched for a long time. Sort of much more like well-known at the time tool was something called Swift-Lint, which was a linter. My boss at the time was very opposed to us using Swift-Lint because he felt like, you know, things that bug you on your PRs about whitespace were very annoying. This is one of the reasons why I didn't want to be the person bugging people about whitespace on their PRs. So like I didn't even suggest like maybe trying to integrate that. At the time, Swift Lint didn't have, I think, any automatic formatting capability. So it couldn't auto-format any of the rules
right.
that it linted about. It was purely just recognizing these issues and then flagging them
and telling
rather than
where
auto-fixing
are.
Them.
Yeah, and it used SourceKitten.
Yeah, so SwiftLint was written by J.P. Simard, and he wrote SourceKitten, which was a Swift wrapper for SourceKit, which is Apple's compiler sort of library. And I took a look at how it worked, and SourceKit didn't really produce the output that I needed. So SourceKit produces an AST, abstract syntax tree, basically, which is sort of the syntax of your file, but with all of the white space and comments and all of the unnecessary like stuff removed. Anything that's not useful to the compiler has been stripped out. And I couldn't see an easy way of getting it to give me, well, basically you need all of that stuff. Like if you want to write a formatter, you actually care about things like
you
white
need
space
the
and so
AST.
On. And okay. I also, in principle, you can write a formatter just with an AST if you're doing like a total formatter, right? Like if you're basically deciding everything, like I'm going to, you know, have a principle where every single line break goes, where every single space goes and all this kind of stuff. But I didn't, that seemed like too much work. Like I didn't want to have a formatter that was that opinionated initially. I just wanted something which could make surgical changes like, you know, removing blank lines, applying indenting, but not having, you know, complete control over the entire formatting of your file. I think if I tried to do that as a first step, it would have been too much to take on. So I, you know, after tinkering with SourceKitten for a while, I just decided like, what I actually just want is, you know, the white space and token information, and then I can just easily figure that out myself. The initial version of Swift format didn't even know about keywords, for example. Like it didn't distinguish between keywords and identifiers because for the purposes of formatting, I didn't really care about the difference. You know, the initial version was literally just doing stuff with white space, you know, making sure that there wasn't multiple spaces between identifiers, making sure that, you know, things were indented properly. And so it was actually quite simple. Basically, all I had to do was write a tokenizer, something that could just go through the string of the source file and identify, oh, this is a, you know, this is like a symbol, this is a bracket, this is an operator or whatever. And that's all it does. And I mean, actually, like, Swift format isn't very much more sophisticated than that now. It's pretty much still just doing the same thing.
The same idea.
Yeah.
But how it had evolved from there?
Well, the main thing that's evolved is just the complexity of the rules. So there's now much more ambitious rules than there were at the time. And in many ways, the rules in Swift format are sort of too ambitious, in that it's a lot of the time the rules are doing things that can't really be done at the level that it's operating. So one of the things that SourceKit does, which Swift format doesn't, is that it actually compiles the project and makes sure that, you know, it's valid code.
Valid Swift.
And most of the time for a formatter, you don't need that. But for some things, you do. Some things can't really safely be done without having that information. And, you know, people often ask me to write rules like, oh, you know, like, we have this naming convention. Can you write a rule that, you know, renames all of these functions to follow this convention? It's like, well, I can't really do that because Swift
format
just...
That's not the point.
Well, it's not that it's not the point. Like, I don't actually... I have no objection to doing that. I think it's a reasonable thing. You know, my view of what a formatter is maybe, like, broader than what a lot of people would consider. It's just not actually possible, because when Swift format is operating on a file, it treats that file in isolation, right? It has no idea of the wider context. So if you have a function name in a file and you rename it, if that's referenced in some other file somewhere, then you're going to break the program. And it can't know that it's doing that because it doesn't know about the rest of your project. One of the things that makes it fast, and Swift format is very fast, it's still faster, I think, than any of the alternatives, is that it can format all of the files in parallel. And again, it's able to do that because it treats them all in isolation. There's no shared information between them.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Swift format, the other project by Apple.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it lives under its own repository.
Yeah. So the only thing that the new Swift dash format has in common with the old one is the name, as far as I can tell. At the time when I wrote Swift format, Swift syntax didn't exist. Like, it wasn't available as a library. It didn't even exist as a concept, really. SourceKit isn't suitable for making formatters or operating at this level, as I said, because it basically produces an AST only, and what you want is a CST, a concrete syntax tree. LibSyntax was the framework that Apple, you know, exposed for handling that kind of level of information. And Swift syntax grew out of LibSyntax. Initially, it was just a Swift overlay for LibSyntax, which is a C++ library. And then eventually it became a standalone library. But this was many, many years later. So since 2017, when Swift syntax first appeared, and then, you know, a few years later on, when it eventually became a standalone library, it then became possible to write a formatter based on that, and that's what the new Swift format from Apple is based on. So it's using the Swift syntax library.
So what are the practical differences?
So Swift syntax is a full parser, not just like a token level thing like Swift format. It actually fully parses the file. It still has the same limitations in terms of it only operates on a single file at a
single
time.
File.
It doesn't have any concept of what these symbols that it's looking at are. It just knows that it's valid syntax. And it's also capable of, you know, applying some correction. Like, if it can handle invalid syntax basically as well and do so safely. I mean, the main advantage to Swift syntax is, first of all, because it's a proper parser, it gives you hierarchical information. So, for example, you know, you can know that a given keyword or a given symbol is part of a function declaration. In Swift format, I have to kind of infer that, or I have to, you know, the rule itself basically has to be like a mini parser that is capable of understanding the relationship between neighboring tokens and sort of maybe building its own simple sort of syntax tree for whatever it is that it needs to do. And some of the rules, that's very complex, and other ones, it's very simple. With Swift syntax, that's all done for you out of the box, which is quite convenient. It comes at a cost, though. There's two costs. One is the library itself is very, very large. Like, it takes a long time to compile and is a big dependency. And also, it's slower. Like, you know, Swift syntax is very fast for what it does, but what it does still takes longer than what Swift format does, which is just, you know, the lexical stage.
I see. That makes sense. And I have a question that is less technical and more general, if we could call that. You've been doing iOS for a while. How do you keep yourself fresh and challenged, and how do you not get bored from doing regular stuff?
I mean, As I said, I have a few things that I personally like passionate about. Like, I really like parsing stuff and language stuff. I like 3D graphics and so on. So mostly I just, you know, like, my day job doesn't usually intersect with these interests. Like, occasionally it does. Like, with Swift Format, I was able to kind of like do a bit of parsing stuff. And I, whenever I get the opportunity to kind of find an excuse to do that, I will. But for the most part, like, my, you know, my day job is pretty regular iOS development. People say, like, we just turn JSON into table views or whatever. I think that's
rectangles.
Everybody does a fair bit of that. And I mean, I enjoy that, but yeah, it's not generally, there's not that much novelty to it. I do like, I think I find it difficult to motivate myself to learn new things unless I have like a reason to do it. So like a project that requires it. And I think probably if I didn't have kind of a regular iOS job, I probably wouldn't have been able to keep up with things like SwiftUI and so on, because I don't really have like a side project that needs them. So I just won't learn them. My own projects just have ended up being just doing the things I already know how to do, like, over and over again. But I have enough variety in the things I do as like sort of programming hobby tasks, and also, you know, the things that come up at work, that I don't find that I get bored.
I see. And did you have any opportunity to do Swift on the server? Is it something that interests you?
I used to do web development, and then I moved into doing like mobile and application development. And it's interesting how things have kind of, they keep going sort of full circle in a way. Like, you know, web developers are now making desktop applications, you know, and desktop application languages like Swift are now moving onto the server. And it seems like you sort of, everybody wants to kind of take the tool they're familiar with and then use it in these different domains.
Everywhere.
But I think for me, kind of moving to mobile and application development meant that I don't really have any interest in going back to the server side particularly. I mean, maybe if it was, you know, if I had a good reason to do something on the server, I guess it would be nice if I could do it in Swift, but I'd need the reason to do it in the first place. mostly I don't. So yeah, like, it makes sense to me that you do server-side stuff in Swift. It seems like a good language for it. I think one of the reasons partly why it's difficult for me to go back to things like web development is because, having sort of tried, you know, strongly typed languages like Swift and things like JavaScript and PHP, and all these languages seem quite primitive by comparison. So I guess, you know, in a sense, I do understand the motivation for wanting to do Swift on the server. But at the moment, it's not something that I have any interest in doing.
So you mentioned server-side Swift, that you... it's not something that interests you so much. What do you feel Swift is missing, and that's an area where you could be more interested into, or maybe you think it's missing maybe components or aspects of other languages?
So I guess one of the reasons I'm interested in sort of parsers and you know, syntax and so on generally is I really like sort of doing meta programming type things with languages. So things like, you know, building tools for working with the language themselves. Yeah, there's a bunch of tools in the Swift ecosystem. Things like Sorcery for doing code manipulation. You've got the macro system now. I recently gave a talk about Swift Syntax, which is Apple's system for like parsing Swift code. And the topic of that talk was this idea of, like, what if you could write an eval function for Swift? Like, could you write Swift code that interprets and runs Swift code? And Swift syntax would be an obvious component in such a system. I mean, the short answer is, like, no, that's a really hard thing to do, but it's a fun idea. And another interesting related thing is Swift WASM, WebAssembly for Swift. There's now a library to run compiled WASM code
in
Swift, like, basically to interpret it. So, you know, what if you could use Swift syntax maybe as part of a tool chain to, at runtime in a Swift program, compile Swift into WebAssembly and then, you know, run it also in Swift. So it's kind of like Swift end-to-end. You could then have some of the capabilities in Swift that we currently have in scripting languages, even though it's a compiled static language and so on, which generally makes, you know, it's a big barrier to doing, like, very dynamic stuff with Swift. If you had that, like, end-to-end tool chain all written in Swift, then you could have, you know, you could make plugin systems, for example. So like for Swift format right now, if you want to add a new rule, you have to like go and edit the source code, recompile the binary, and then you can add your
and
rule.
Distribute to everyone.
Yeah, and it's not really practical. And then, of course, like distribution is also a huge problem because you've got all the signing and everything, and you have to have an Apple developer account, and it's just too much of a pain for typical people. But if you had this kind of ability to just evaluate Swift code at runtime, even if the performance wouldn't necessarily be as good, you could, you know, you could write your Swift format rules just as a text file and then import it, and you could have like a plugin system, right? And you could just write your own rules and run them without having to rebuild everything and go through Xcode and go through distribution and signing. You could do cool stuff in apps. It's possible to make apps scriptable right now using JavaScript, because Apple provides like a JavaScript runtime.
Core.
But there's no way to make them scriptable using Swift, really, because there's no equivalent thing. So yeah, I think that's a cool area. That's something that interests me.
But do you think it's by design like this? Or
no, I don't think I don't think Apple is like fundamentally opposed to people running Swift code at runtime. I mean, it might introduce some security concerns, but probably nothing that's not already, you know, a problem with things like running JavaScript. And,
yeah.
You know, over time, Apple has become more relaxed around this. Like in the early days of the App Store, they had a no virtual machines policy. And then that became sort of like only our virtual machines. And now it seems to have just pretty much gone away altogether. I think they're kind of... I think they're not opposed to it. It's just a matter of focus, right? Like with, you know, with server-side Swift, with running Swift on Android, with running Swift on Windows, like with WASM, like all of these things, it's not that Apple doesn't like them. It's not, I mean, in a lot of the cases, it's actual Apple employees are pushing these things, but it's just not really part of the company strategy. I think that's why there's not a lot of like momentum behind them. It's, you know, people who are enthusiastic about these things are pushing them forward, but it's not Apple themselves.
Yeah. Makes sense. All right. These are all very interesting answers, and it's really interesting to learn about the origins of Swift format and how you build it. We'll leave links for these projects on the show notes and also for your socials. Thank you so much, Nick, for your insights, for sharing your experience and your tips. Thank you so much, and we'll be in touch. See you next time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.